welcome to Temple of Health Radio Show. This is Dr. Susan Kolb, and today I'm pleased to announce as my guest Dr. David Lowe. Dr. Lowe's been on the show several times, and his previous interviews can be found at www.plasticus.com under Resources and Radio with the archives there. Today we're going to be talking about Islam, and this interview will be up in about a week as well. Welcome, Dr. Lowe. Thank you very much for joining us.
It's great to be here, Susan. Wonderful to be on again. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. So if you'll give us a little bit of information on Islam, I know there's a lot of information in the news, the Muslim religion, its origins, and very controversial right now whether or not the teachings of Muhammad actually encourage people to behave in certain ways in regards to terrorism. Would you like to start a little bit with the background of Islam and how it came about?
Sure. Well, my idea was to talk primarily about its unfortunate connection with terrorist activity and to sort of have us understand the faith at a deeper level.
Right.
But basically, yeah, you're talking about early 7th century Arabia, which wasn't a country at the time. Muhammad had a more difficult time civilizing a group of people than any other religious leader ever had.
Mm-hmm.
I think a really important thing to understand about it is that, well, Judaism, Christianity kind of grew up under political authority, you know, Roman Empire. You were expected to be literate, to have some manners and decorum and everything when you're dealing with your emperors and so forth. There was none of that in ancient Arabia, okay? It was, the whole area was inhabited by a shifting patchwork of tribes who fought each other periodically out of long-running blood feuds. It was a very, very savage culture. And that impacted the content of the Quran big time.
Mm-hmm.
So the major thing to understand about the faith is, well, the most difficult politically, in terms of being politically correct, the most difficult thing to talk about is this marvelous book, the Quran, which has extraordinary divinity connected with it, but which at the same time has some objectionable content. And there are lots of reasons for the whole terrorist association. Islam has more baggage historically than probably any other faith in terms of negative baggage. But its mysticism is just as great as any. Its teachings are just as great as any. But there are some problematic aspects with its background, which are unfortunate. I was thinking of trying to clarify today for everybody. But
well, let's start out with a little bit with how many people in the world are practicing this religion. I think a lot of people don't realize how prevalent
it's over a billion people. It's the most portable religion in the world, primarily because its monotheism is so pure and severe that you don't associate God with anything. So there's not a whole lot of stuff to carry around. Converting to it is easier than any other faith. You just stand there in front of a couple of other Muslims, face Mecca, and say, there is no God but God, and Muhammad is his messenger. And you're in.
Mm-hmm.
You're in. So it's a huge faith. It is expansionist, like Christianity, historically.
Mm-hmm.
North Africa, Middle East, Indonesia, which is a huge portion of the Far East, huge portions of the world are primarily demographically dominated by Islam. Sure.
So we had three religions that were probably within, what would you say, Christianity and Islam are within 700 years of each other, is that right?
Right. Yeah.
And Judaism, which was the third, was predated that by some, would you say, at least
1,700
years
before that. Yeah. You're talking about 1700 BCE.
Okay,
that's,
so 1,700 years, really.
Yeah, 1700 BCE is Abraham's revelation at Mount Sinai, Moses at Mount Sinai. That's the first covenant. followed by Jesus, the Jesus event, and that's the new covenant, which for Christians superseded all the Jewish stuff. And then Muhammad's revelation in 7th century Arabia superseded even that. So for Muslims, that is like the third covenant between God and man, essentially.
The interesting thing is that Moses is mentioned a huge number of times in the Quran.
Sure.
Isn't that odd that is?
Well, no. The Quran is the first major ancient scripture. It came along relatively late in the ancient period. As such, it's the only major ancient scripture which talks about other faiths, namely Judaism and Christianity for the most part. And 9/10 of what it says about those other faiths is very complimentary and wonderful. But a couple of little passages here and there are problematic. So, yeah, but it talks about Moses in a very complimentary way. Moses was one of the seven rasuls, or great messengers. Mm-hmm. There are thousands of prophets sent to all cultures throughout history, as they say. And there are seven special ones in Islamic theology. There's Adam, Moses, Jesus, Muhammad, and three others. I don't remember who they are. But, Moses was a very important prophet associated with the first revelation, the first big, Adam. You see, the interesting thing about these seven rasuls, all seven of them revealed Islam in its completion, in its totality, but people weren't ready to listen.
Right.
It was only in 7th century Arabia that enough people were able to listen to Muhammad sufficiently to get the final revelation. So because of that, there have been no other true great prophets since then.
So tell us a little bit about Muhammad. I don't think very many, at least Christians, know that much about Muhammad.
Right. Well, we know a lot about him because there are references that you can cross-check and so forth. Compared with Jesus or Confucius, people like that, we know a lot more about him reliably. He was born in Mecca. He grew up, seems to have grown up a shepherd, very nice, morally disposed kid, very widely regarded as a very well-behaved person. He married a lady who, as a woman, was more fortunate than probably anyone else in ancient Arabia. She inherited a camel caravan business from her husband, so she wasn't persecuted and so forth, and she wasn't picked on and treated like property as most women were back then.
Mm-hmm.
So she married Muhammad, and he basically worked as sort of a camel caravan manager. Mm-hmm. Of people coming and going through town. Mecca was on a trade route. So Muhammad, he was illiterate. He couldn't read or write, but all these people coming through Mecca acquainted him with all these different religions and philosophies. He was very well grounded in all that stuff, from all the conversations in taverns and campfires and so forth. So anyway, he was in the habit of meditating outside town, being a very piously disposed kid. And he had this one day, the angel Gabriel came to him and said, "Recite." And he began reciting all of this beautiful poetic material. Mm-hmm. And over the course of his life, for the next 30 years or so, over the course of the next 20 or 30 years of his life, there were periods when he would come out with these revelations. And he was very specific about when they would happen and when they wouldn't. Now, get out your pens and paper, and I feel it coming on. So that is what comprises the Quran, a literal verbal revelation through Muhammad of this wonderful poetic material, which is mysteriously and paradoxically impacted, of course, by the culture that he grew up in.
Right.
Yeah. And the interesting
Just a little bit more about the culture. He was in a pretty big city, if it was Mecca, is that right?
Mecca itself
more cosmopolitan.
Mecca itself had a municipal structure and authority. The tribe that Muhammad was a member of was a tribe which ran the town. Mm-hmm. You couldn't fight once you got within 10 or 20 miles of Mecca, one of those unwritten rules. But outside that, the culture was pretty savage, infanticide with girls and so forth. So that impacted his life, and that impacted the quality of the Quran. He didn't like his culture at all, Muhammad. Mm-hmm. He was very repelled by all the customs that were around him, the gambling, mm-hmm. the infanticide, the poor treatment of women, and so forth.
Right.
And his teachings manifested as really a platform of social reform.
Right.
He was the world's first, male feminist religious leader. Better treatment of women, duties to the poor, elimination of savage customs like infanticide and so forth. A very, very highly beneficial effect on everybody around him at the time. Yeah, he was a major influence, and in terms of breakthroughs for social reform, better treatment of women, and even if that isn't always well carried out today, the ideal mm-hmm. is there. Again, it's unfortunate how inevitably the culture of the time, the Quran was meant to be addressed to. It was addressed to mm-hmm. illiterate, relatively savage warriors who were accustomed to fighting and stealing. Basically a region of bandits. So they had to be, as it were, civilized, but they also needed to be addressed in their own idiom and at their mm-hmm. own ethical level. So that impacted the quality of the book.
So what would you say are some of the major differences between Islam and Judaism and Christianity?
There are all kinds of, historical and cultural differences, the way things are said and so forth. And, of course, it's all the same underneath at the deeper levels. But mm-hmm. I would say three things. Jesus wasn't crucified. It was made to appear that way. Okay,
right.
God would never do that to one of his prophets. Okay.
Yeah, and he survived the crucifixion.
Right. Well, no, he wasn't crucified at all.
Oh, okay.
It was made to appear that way. Okay. God would never do that to one of his prophets. Another thing was zakat, the custom of giving and charity. I think Islam, to its credit, is the first. It's the only really major faith to advocate as a frontline scriptural requirement, giving charity. Okay, mm-hmm. So that's something which I think that the other faiths in spirit also preach that, but Islam has it out right there, literally, as a scriptural requirement. So I think mm-hmm. that's good. Another thing, the other major thing, again, is its theory of prophecy. Okay, mm-hmm. There are three revelations. Moses long ago in Judaism, 1700 BCE at Mount Sinai, then the Jesus event, and then Muhammad's revelation, which supersedes both those two. So mm-hmm. Those would be the major overall differences in terms of, there are other minor things, but those are the major ones that I think people should bear in mind.
Okay. Let's see. One of the Islam's big themes is brotherhood.
Right.
What is brotherhood?
Well, it's, ideally for Muslims, it is the unique primordial religion, which everyone should sort of intuitively tune into. So it's really kind of a sore point among Muslims that there are any sects in the faith, but inevitably there are.
Mm-hmm.
More so than any other faith, Islam was meant, and it shares with Christianity, but I think Islam especially, there are passages in the Quran which imply or say directly, this is for all mankind. Okay,
right.
More so than any other faith, this notion of being for everybody is emphasized. So there is this universal vision, which of course is rarely met and rarely felt, but it is there, and it does continue to inspire Muslims to all sort of somehow be on the same page. But there are sects, of course, in Islam, just as there are.
So just like in Christianity, where the Catholic Church ruled for a period of time and then Protestants broke off and there was a lot of different Protestant churches, what happened within Islam with the different sects, and why is there so much, religious contention, like,
right,
say, in Iraq?
Right. Well, it's interesting. The Sunni and Shia sects, which is the major groups in Islam, Sunni is about mm-hmm. 85% of the community, Shia is about 15%. They lived peacefully for centuries and centuries with mm-hmm. some underlying tensions because of theological differences, but they basically lived in peace until there were political influences due to Western intrusion. That's why mm-hmm. they're fighting for the most part. But there are theological differences. Basically, about sometime after Muhammad died, there were four what they call rightly guided successors, three of whom basically, after he died, Muhammad died, there was kind of a crisis in the community. They're figuring out, what kind of leader do we have now? Because Muhammad didn't appoint anybody.
Mm-hmm.
So most people wanted a leader who was only a political and administrative leader, who would be advised by scholars on spiritual matters. But mm-hmm. a minority, the Shia, wanted a leader who was a blood relative of Muhammad,
mm-hmm.
Someone who would therefore retain his same prophetic powers, his same prophetic
right.
quality. So he would continue as a spiritual as well as a political leader.
Right.
And with the fourth successor of Muhammad who came along, the fourth caliph was Ali, which was the guy who the Shia wanted. Ali was Muhammad's cousin and son-in-law.
Mm-hmm.
So he was elected as the fourth caliph. He was then assassinated sometime later. And the Shia, because of that, all of the political stuff which went down in connection with that event, the Shia essentially broke off and became mm-hmm. their own group. The word Shia means faction. Okay, Sunni okay. straight path, the Shia the faction. And the Shia broke off from Sunni Islam on those theological differences around the notion that their leader should be both a spiritual as well as a political leader, instead of just a political leader. That's the big
yeah,
difference.
It's so interesting that
the
they recognize that the prophecy and the gifts of the Spirit are in the bloodline, because they really
right.
are.
Right. Right. Well, you know, I mean, the whole notion of prophecy doesn't make sense to me, but, you know, for most people in the Western religions, it's a very big thing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
An interesting difference between, like in Christianity, okay, the idea is to be like Jesus, okay, you imitate Christ. So there are such things as saints. They call them saints, people who mm-hmm. attain self-realization and so forth, to be like Jesus. In traditional Islam, as well as Judaism, the orientation is totally different, because you get the law, moral laws and mm-hmm. guidelines through your prophets, and they apply to everybody in the faith. There are places in the Quran where Muhammad is reprimanded by God for not obeying his own rules and guidelines. Mm-hmm. So a prophet technically is somebody who could be anyone whom God chooses to deliver a message. But he himself has sinful tendencies, like anyone else.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so technically, Orthodox Jews and Orthodox Muslims don't believe in saints. Okay, they don't mm-hmm. believe in self-realization. All that's very arrogant, delusional mm-hmm. nonsense. But prophecy is very important in its traditional definition.
So there was a more recent prophet that led to the Baha'i religion, is that correct?
Right. Right. Yeah, yeah. I don't know
that?
Much about the Baha'i, other than that they are connected with the Shia, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And there are various sects of Shiism. The Ahmadiyyas are a better known one, actually. Well, mm-hmm. not as well known as the Baha'i, whose prophet is alive today. Okay, so
yeah.
so the Ahmadiyyas think that the prophets are already here.
Mm-hmm.
Most Shia Muslims and groups derived from the Shia think that the prophet is what they call in occultation. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Basically, the Shia believe in not only in the teachings of Muhammad, but in the teachings of a number of his descendants. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And that line of descendants stopped at a certain point where the last person either was lost or murdered or something. And
right.
he lives in occultation, some other reality. Okay? And
mm-hmm.
his teachings are interpreted by special mullahs or ayatollahs who are qualified to sort to somehow discern what his teachings would be
mm-hmm.
If he were on earth today. And that Mahdi, who is called, will come again as a Messiah at the right time. He will come out of occultation, appear on earth, and save everybody.
So when is that prophecy, say this person's coming back?
We don't know. It's Allah's time.
Not known.
Allah will decide when that's going to be. You know, what's interesting, you know, in the time, one interesting thing that a Muhammad said, and this is a pretty reliable hadith tradition, is that in the times leading up to the end times, like just before the Day of Judgment, like about now maybe, women singers...
Like about now maybe. That's
right.
Great. I agree. I think it is now.
What he said was women singers would become popular.
Interesting.
That's what he said. So here we are.
Yeah.
You know.
And women singers are actually some of the most popular in the world.
Exactly, exactly.
They
so
really
here
are.
We are just, and so he
Which
said
is
that.
Unusual. You know, we had this whole male singer thing, you know, through many. And right now, female singers are the most popular in the world.
Yeah, absolutely.
Since Michael Jackson died, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, very interesting.
And so this is one of the issues with, you know, what they call cultural pollution. There are five or six major factors linking with accounting for why Islam tends to be associated with terrorist activity. You know,
okay.
Problematic scriptural language is the biggest and most...
Calling for jihad?
Well, yeah. I mean, the whole thing with jihad, the actual meaning of jihad refers to inner struggle. Okay, there are three dimensions to jihad. There's a political jihad, there's a social jihad, and there's this inner, internal, mystical jihad, which involves overcoming your negativities and purification and all that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the factors, what you could call cultural pollution. I mean, the very, very inevitably modernity, the process of modernization causes it to happen. To these traditional cultures. Women get interested in getting more education, they get jobs, they start earning more money than their husbands, which causes problems.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, United Nations peacekeeping forces will sell music videos to kids, and those music videos has Beyonce on there, you know, performing three quarters naked on the stage and everything. And so, you know, there are all these, so these things disrupt traditional patterns of life. And there's tremendous resentment about that amongst traditionally minded Muslims in these societies, in these old societies. And then there's female circumcision or genital mutilation, which has nothing to do with Islam. It was in those cultures before Islam got there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, but as a result of that, it inevitably becomes strongly associated with the faith over the centuries.
I'm an expert in problems in that area, and I actually treat a lot of patients who've had female circumcision.
Yeah.
Sometimes the scar tissue can be undone and better function can occur.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, it's done, of course, to, you know, blunt sexual desire, make women more submissive and so forth.
Right.
So, yeah, but the thing is to understand is that it became associated with the teachings of the faith. It's a law of God that you should do this.
Well, just like circumcision with Judaism.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. And it's perpetrated by the women, and by the older women who don't want their daughters to have any more fun than they did. So it's a very difficult, you know, situation to gradually be overcome through better education and so forth. But what I really want to see folks understand is the whole situation with, like, fundamentalist religion in general. You know, any religion, but especially these expansionist ones, Christianity and Islam. You know, you have this one God, right? And you identify your ego with God. And you have this notion that you have the one true way, and others aren't as good. And because you have the one true way, you feel morally obligated to get everybody else on board. You know, but you know, I don't think that's really right. And when all is said and done, we're all the same deep down. So these folks are living with this profound insecurity, and the only way that they can keep convincing themselves that they're right is to conquer everybody else. You know, I mean, that is religious warfare in a nutshell.
Right.
I really think so. So, you know, you get these notions, these expansionist religions, you will go ahead and conquer everybody for their own good. And that didn't happen with Judaism because, of course, Judaism is a very small group of people. It's a culture and ethnicity as well as a religion. But Islam and Christianity, being strictly monotheistic in that way, your ego associates with God. You ascend to God, and you want to convert everybody else, since you have something that they don't. But because deep down you're wrong, you're extraordinarily insecure about it, which makes you want to keep convincing yourself that you're right by conquering other people. That's the whole. I'm convinced that that's the whole dynamic behind religious warfare throughout history.
Yeah, I think one of the big problems is, the world's dependence on oil and the fact that the Arab countries have much of the oil supply, or at least did until other routes were found in Russia and, offshore drilling. But
right.
I don't know if you know this, but President Trump signed an executive order recently saying that medical technologies and free energy technologies need to be released soon, primarily out of the secret space program. And once this happens, I think that there'll be even less money to be made in oil. And because of that, the political power of Islam is going to go down. I mean, it's going to, right now, a lot of the terrorist activities are funded indirectly through the oil industry and people who run that industry supporting the terrorist organizations. And as financial support is very important if you're trying to take over the world. You know, if you don't really have much of a chance of it if you don't have the financial support. So
it's
moving away from that. Isn't oil isn't it like $31 a barrel now or something? And it used to be 130. I mean, it's
whatever. That
it's being defunded.
Right. That does relate to 20th century factors which go into which went into determining what happened to a lot of Muslim countries after the Axis powers withdrew and after the colonial powers withdrew.
Uh-huh.
What happened was, they put in place to rule these countries in order to sort of knit them back together politically. They put in place these sort of strongmen who had military positions in these countries, and the hope was that they would all become good democracies. They didn't. They ended up being basically them and their cronies getting really rich, and everybody else getting very, very poor. So
but even in Saudi Arabia and Kuwait, and I mean the country is wealthy. Even Iran is a wealthy country. They have high levels of education. They have, their infrastructure is in much better shape than our infrastructure. I mean, it's almost like the entire country, even though it is somewhat backward for women especially, but the entire country has great opportunity for its citizens because of the oil money.
In the big cities it does, but in the hinterlands they don't. That's the whole, and this is the whole issue with another overall tendency was that for oil companies, it's very easy for oil companies to go in and make deals with these rulers who have all this power. They don't have to go through a democratic process of being approved by the whole country.
Right, yeah, it's a lot easier.
And so they come right in and essentially start a new form of colonialism.
Right.
Which is, it's a big overall issue, which these countries are slowly becoming more conscious of.
Well, certainly with the oil prices going down and our dependence on oil going the other way, not being as dependent on oil, I think the political climate for Islam is shifting rapidly. I mean, it's away from its power.
Yeah, I certainly hope so. Yeah, it's a very important. Let's see, we've covered another thing which I think people need to be aware of is the reason why a major reason motivating all this terrorist activity is that Islam is more successful historically than any other religion in terms of political rule. Okay, I mean, for centuries, in the Middle East, North Africa, India, Pakistan, Europe, Central, South, all these areas of the world were ruled by Muslim empires, sometimes very, very well. There were interruptions with the Mongol Empire and the Crusades and so forth, but for long periods of time, there were huge empires run by Muslims. And so as a result of that, you know, these hardliners insist on, you know, I mean, modern Muslims who are educated realize that Sharia law can't possibly apply in democracy for the most part. But these hardliners, they think that Islam proper cannot exist unless it has political rule as well as demographic dominance. And that's like a big issue. So, I mean, how can this faith coexist in a, you know, modern pluralistic democracy? That's a huge question.
I don't think it can. I mean, it doesn't seem to me that it can coexist. It doesn't really want to coexist. It wants to take over and make everybody comply with the law that they believe in.
In its super traditional form, it doesn't want to coexist.
Right.
But again, modern educated Muslims realize that this is an issue and it can't pass. It's no problem for them. You know, 3 out of 4 educated Muslims, that's not an issue. It's perfectly okay to eliminate most of Sharia law, use only a little bit of it for like domestic purposes, but the rest of it, chuck it out the window so we can have a democracy. It's only these hardliners who insist on this notion of having a caliphate. Of there being political rule as well as demographic. It's very important to understand that distinction. It's only that these 10% of the population, the hardliners, they're the problem. Most educated Muslims is no big deal at all. We want to be part of a democracy.
Well, we have, you know, as you said before, we're approaching energetic shifts that are pretty significant, and I think that probably these energetic shifts are going to have quite a profound effect on the fundamentalists of all of the religions, and it won't be in a positive direction.
Well, I think it's what's interesting, again, this planetary awakening, a lot of things have to get worse before they get better. And our new president is sure waking us up big time, you know. I mean, as repulsive as some of the things he's advocating are, he's what we need to really wake up.
Yeah, David Wilcox said he's like a battering ram against the powers that be. There's an all-out war going on. Most people don't realize it. There's an all-out war going on between the powers that be and the Trump administration. And there is reports of potential terrorist attacks in major cities, and There was a rumor going around last week that Atlanta would be hit, and of course you heard about what happened a few days ago. I guess it was 2 days ago.
I'm actually calling from a spiritual retreat right now.
Oh, so you don't know?
No, I don't know. A major
bridge in close to downtown Atlanta caught fire. It's 6 p.m. Fortunately, nobody was killed, but there's a huge traffic problem now because of that. The bridge actually collapsed. And, of course, they said it wasn't terrorism, which I don't believe it was Islamic terrorism, but I do believe it was part of this battle between the powers that be and the current administration. And there's supposed to be more attacks against the infrastructure of the U.S., so we'll see what happens, but
I think, you know,
there was something called red mercury involved. Who knows what will happen, because unfortunately the people investigating it may be compromised. So, but anyway, people need to pay attention as to what happens in the next few months, or probably next few weeks, in terms of domestic terrorism.
Right. Well, one thing I wanted to get folks to understand about Islam, another thing is that, you know, Islam and Judaism are both communal faiths. The orientation is different. In Christianity, it's like to be like God, to be like Jesus, to become a saint.
Mm-hmm.
In Islam, it's like do as God says.
Right, the law.
So everybody, and that law covers all areas of life.
Right.
Land use,
just
business,
like Judaism
contract.
Does. I mean,
right, exactly. Land use, business contracts, exchange of prisoners, domestic life, religious stuff. It's like it's the whole way of life aspect is much more accentuated
right.
in Islam. And so it's you know, it's very communal. And they, again, there's a notion of, you know, when Muslim communities want to build mosques around the country, mm-hmm. and people react against it, it's not the actual mosque and praxis that they're worried about, but this notion of Sharia law is going to replace
right.
the Constitution. That's what people are afraid of. And again,
yeah.
it can't possibly do that, except in maybe a very small scale locally in the domestic sphere, maybe.
Right.
But otherwise, you just have to toss it out the window in order to be in a pluralistic democracy.
It reminds me a little bit about Catholicism, with, you know, facing this global crisis of overpopulation, but refusing to use birth control. You know, it's like when do you change the old laws because of the new problems? You know.
Yeah, yeah, and this, I mean, for me, the human race is this out of control reproductive juggernaut. You know.
It is. It is.
How do we stop? How do we
well,
stop?
Well, you know, it's so interesting. I don't know whether I mentioned this to you before, but you can download this book called Alien Mind, which
uh-huh.
is an investigative journalist, 10,000 hours interviewing aliens that work with our government. And, of course, they know the problems of emerging planets like ours. And one of the biggest problems is overpopulation. And then the second biggest problem is what do you do when you create nukes but don't yet have the ability to contain them? And, you know, certain planets have gone ahead and blown themselves up. You know, fortunately, we haven't. But so the big problems are nuclear weapons, which is why all the extraterrestrial activity occurred
uh-huh.
right around the time we started doing that, because that got attention to us. And then the overpopulation thing, you really, historically, in planets that are emerging like ours, they become asexual. In other words, children are done by cloning, not cloning, but test tube, more babies rather than sex. So other planets make the transition into an asexual reproduction, and then the children are raised in a much more controlled and probably a better manner than just allowing them to be raised in any household, which may or may not be loving and, you know, take good care of them. And that's something that each planet has to go through. But they talk about historically the things that make planets successful in getting to the next level, which of
right.
course is the ascension. And
so
we're in that now.
Right.
And it's just very interesting to read that book.
Right.
And
so
understand that every planet goes through these birthing processes.
Mm-hmm.
And control
so
the population
theory,
is a big
right,
one.
What you, so let me get this right. In this theory, people would be reproduced asexually after a while.
Well, this is just historical from their standpoint. You
right.
know, they've seen 1,000 planets like Earth evolve, okay?
Right.
Some of these beings are like 11 million years old, okay?
Right.
They, you know,
what that implies
history.
To me is a very interesting spiritual situation with that. In order for
uh-huh.
that to be, we all have to attain, you know, well, enlightenment, self-realization.
Exactly.
The yin
to
and
survive.
The yang coming together. The yin and the
yeah.
yang together, so that sex is no longer necessary for bliss and joy and so forth.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
So they say most successful planets, the ones that, you know, have no war, the ones that are able to, you know, have the best level of living for all their population, are mostly went the route of asexual. In other words, people no longer have sex for procreation. Now, they may have sex for enjoyment. I'm not saying that sex is eliminated, but for procreation, other more advanced methods occur, so that there, you know, there aren't as many genetic mutations and problems, and, you know, so each child has a good genetic background and good care. But anyway, just read the book; it's very, very interesting.
I certainly looked at it. I will say
you and
that
I don't have
that. that I do have reservations about all these things, but it's fascinating. I sure hope you're right about some of these theories and extraterrestrial stuff and so forth. I really would look forward to seeing that.
Just like
come
everything,
into fruition.
There's good extraterrestrials, the ones that are very highly evolved and are fifth and sixth dimensional. And then there's the grays and the ones responsible for abduction and the ones that work with our government who are a lot less spiritually evolved. So it's like anything else. So, extraterrestrial is not one thing.
Let me ask you, in terms of disclosure, I mean, folks like me are going to need like a childhood end kind of disclosure.
Right.
Did you see that TV series, Childhood's End?
No, I didn't.
You didn't see that? Oh, that's a marvelous. Anyway, that is the granddaddy of all science fiction Earth invasion novels. It's wonderful. You should read it. But the great disclosure, which like occurs at the end of it, is that the aliens come out and physically show themselves in front of everybody. This mm-hmm. big, giant, and all the cameras are there all over the world, this big day announced ahead of time, and wow, there they are. And everybody gets blown away. That's what folks like me, I suppose I could use a more subtle form of disclosure. Maybe I'll be tuned into that somehow, but most people
there's
gonna are going to need...
There's going to be a gradual form of disclosure so as not to shock people who may be mentally unstable. I mean, the secret space program has already addressed that. And you might remember back a few years ago, Mars had no life on it, no water, no nothing. And now they've announced that Mars has water, Mars has plant life. Pretty soon you'll see some animal life revealed.
Well,
it's
going to
be gradual like that, but it's
going to
be very quick.
In my understanding, Mars has water underneath, frozen, and it'll take about 500 years of terraforming on our part before it can be fixed. That's not true.
We have colonies on Mars, and we've had colonies on Mars for at least since the time of Eisenhower. So
that would be so cool.
And I mean, people, there's a huge amount of information on that. If you want to go, the official spokesperson for the secret space program is Captain Randy Kramer.
Right. I've listened to Randy. It's fascinating.
It is, he points out that if he wasn't real, he would have been arrested by now because it's a felony to impersonate an officer. And he's been in contact with the NSA and with all these organizations, Congress, and nobody's arrested him. So that's pretty good proof that he's who he says he is. They can't because he is real.
What I have trouble with is the notion that NASA would somehow substitute or fool everybody into thinking that Mars's conditions are different than they are.
Well, look at it this way. I don't know how old you are, but when I was in elementary school, we put a man on the moon, okay? We haven't done jack crap since then, okay? How mm-hmm. could that be? I mean, just logically, how could it be that in, 50 years, and we've done nothing other than put a shuttle up. That's
all
ridiculous.
All sorts of budgetary and political reasons caused that.
No, there isn't. Not at all. There were excuses because the secret space program was very, very important for defense of the country. I'm not arguing that we didn't do the right thing. I think we did do the right thing because I don't think that politically Earth is ready for what the secret space program has until we go through the ascension. But I think once we get through this period of time that we're in and eliminate some of the more negative aspects of humanity that would take advantage and abuse this technology, I think that they did the right thing. But logically, it doesn't make any sense that we didn't even go back to the moon in 50 years.
God, I sure hope you're right about all this stuff.
About it. I know I am. I'm in contact with people all the time.
Right. For me, like Carl Sagan said, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence.
This stuff is old news. We've been doing this since Eisenhower.
Well, I do know that, you know,
all of this is very advanced.
Those undersea cities, especially the one off Cuba, there have definitely been intelligence, big intelligence on the planet in the past, major. That's incontrovertible.
Yeah, I mean, there are spacecraft in Antarctica that are 30 miles long that, according to David Wilcox, have a bunch of dead extraterrestrials on them and then some still in stasis. You know, I mean, they can't deny disclosure anymore. But
well, we'll see. We'll see.
Yeah.
But the only thing that really convinces me that there have been intelligence on the Earth in the past is the city off of Cuba, the one that's 3,000 feet down.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's no excuse for ignoring that. You know,
yeah,
the implications of the existence of that place is just extraordinary for me.
I think you can go to Google Earth and see what they're unearthing in Antarctica. I really think you can. You can take a look for yourself.
Okay.
But anyway, we're coming to the end of our hour. Would you like to give your contact information?
Yeah, I'm David Lowe. Universal Spiritual Philosophy and Practice. The website is David Lowe, no E, David Lowe, LOWMSPHD.com. Or email me at David@worldspirituality.com.
Great.
Yeah. Cool.
Well, David, thanks so much for joining us today. It's been a great discussion. And I know we're going to have you back, so we'll have you back in the future, and we'll continue the discussion.
That's wonderful, Susan. Thanks so much for allowing me on. Take care.
Okay. Take care.
Bye-bye.
This is Dr. Susan Kolb with Temple of Health Radio Show. Next week, we're interviewing Ellen Tad, The Infinite View. And then Carolyn Gervaris, Life Before Life, How Soul Agreements Direct Our Destiny. And then the week after that, Vishnu Swami with Eternal Dharma. We are in remarkable times now. Take a look at YouTube, the information on the Secret Space Program, David Wilcox's latest releases on what's going on in Antarctica, and prepare yourself for these new releases as ordered by President Trump. Thank you very much.